I came from Venice, Italy, just last night, especially to meet all of you today. I'm very honored that Mr. Ajay Piramal has joined us. Although in his humility, he's just sitting amongst us. He's actually one of the most prominent and highly respected industrialists and businessmen in all of India. He has international corporations, pharmaceutical corporations, textile industries. His family owns the largest luggage manufacturer of India, largest pharmaceutical company. And he's in India, you see him in the newspapers, magazines all of the time. But what's so wonderful is, although he's so successful, so dynamic, he has such natural devotion to God, and therefore such wonderful qualities, which we're really hoping that the youth of the world can recognize and be inspired by. We're very honored by your wonderful association today. I'm very close with his mother, who comes to our temple in Bombay very, very often. Today I was asked to speak on the subject of... What is the subject?
Overcoming the obstacles in practicing spiritual life.
Overcoming obstacles. In all walks of life, the greatness of a person is really how we deal with obstacles. And the greater the obstacles, the greater we become when we overcome them with integrity. Obstacles are like tests. Just like in your college you have exams. I don't know too many students that really like exams. They're obstacles. However, because they're difficult, because they impose a difficulty, a challenge before us, therefore, in order to pass, we have to go very, very deep into the subject. We have to prepare ourselves. And in this way, because of that test, we become stronger, more learned, and more realized in the subject. And life is like that. Tests will come before us whether we like it or not, whether we plan it or not. Now, how we perceive that imposition is how we are going to respond. A great person sees difficulties, obstacles, even tragedies as an opportunity to grow. Whereas a smaller-minded person simply becomes discouraged. Because we cannot see the possibility for growth within that situation. A past Prime Minister of the UK, Winston Churchill, he said, a great person is one who goes through failure after failure after failure after failure and never gives up enthusiasm. Because even in failure, there's so much to learn. And in that learning, how much we can grow for far greater horizons of success. And this is true in every field of life. The greater the resistance, the greater the opportunity to develop from it. Yes? In athletics, training really means allowing resistance to come upon us, like weightlifting. In weightlifting, we're actually fighting against resistance. And the more determined we are to fight against that resistance, and the greater the resistance, the stronger we become. In running, the resistance is getting tired. But the more determined we are to struggle and strive against that fatigue, the more we develop, the more we grow, the more we become empowered. That is the law of nature. And it could apply to every aspect of life. There's a very famous example of one small girl. She had polio. She couldn't walk. One of her legs was completely dysfunctional and deformed. And the best doctors in the area proclaimed that she would never be able to walk normally her whole life. In fact, she would never be able to walk her whole life. Excuse me. It's an obstacle. I have some congestion due to traveling so much. So her mother encouraged her that whatever the doctor said, you can try. So she tried and she tried. And gradually, after some years, when she was about 11, she could actually kind of walk. And then she decided she wanted to run. So she entered into a race. And she came in last place in this race, way behind everybody else. And then she started some other trainings and all of that. She was determined. Pretty big obstacle. This person, Wilma Rudolph, have you heard of her? She won 3 gold medals in the International Olympics as the fastest woman on earth. Incredible. How is that possible? Such obstacle, but she didn't give up. In fact, probably one of the reasons why she won 3 gold medals and was declared the fastest woman on earth was because the obstacles that were put before her just gave her so much determination. And she never gave up hope. She saw her inabilities as opportunities. And therefore she succeeded in a wonderful way. Walt Disney, the first job he tried to get as a cartoonist, he was fired because they said he had a lack of creativity. Now that's an obstacle. Being defamed. Being kicked out of your job. But he didn't give up. Failures are stepping stones to great success if we see the opportunity. Yes, within this world, for anything we want to accomplish, there will be so many obstacles. And our greatness is how we are enthusiastic with hope and determination to seize the opportunity of that situation and pursue. And that very much applies to spirituality as well. The greater the resistance, the greater the opportunity to develop. Today is Easter Sunday. And all over the world, Christians are celebrating the glorious rising of Jesus Christ from the dead. Yes? Good Friday, which celebrates his crucifixion, was a major obstacle. Serious obstacle. How many of you have faced that obstacle? Being sentenced to death, being tortured and whipped, having to publicly be humiliated by carrying a cross and being through all the crowds, just in a helpless condition. And then so much pain. That's a major obstacle. It was not only a major obstacle for Jesus, but it was a major obstacle for all of his followers. But actually, today, Easter, when he actually rose, made the whole obstacle the main theme of their whole religion. On top of every church and on the chest of most Christians throughout the world, you see the crucifix. What does the crucifix represent? Torture, obstacle, hardship. But because he rose through that obstacle by the power of God, Christians actually use that incident, to develop faith in people's hearts all over the world. It's the prime theme of the whole religion. is the crucifixion and the rise of Christ, is it not? It gives so much spiritual validity to everything he spoke. So Easter Sunday is really a day when we see how from an obstacle can come the most incredible opportunity, the most incredible success and potential. Similarly, our own Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, how much obstacles he faced in his spirit of trying to show compassion to others. I will share with you a very brief history. When he was 70 years old, it was his great yearning in his heart to share the joy and the beauty of his love for God with people all over the world. Because you see, someone who theoretically has a conviction, a religious conviction, they want to spread the word to others, because they have an intellectual conception that this will be good for them. It will also be good for me. And oftentimes that theoretical conviction can become sentimentalism, sectarianism, fanaticism. But for a person who's actually tasting the joy, the fulfillment, the experience of God, the all-beautiful, all-loving Lord within our hearts, for that person, feel so much compassion for people who do not have that joy. Because it is the nature of every living being to love. The origin of that love is the soul's love for the Supreme. And in this world, people are struggling and toiling so hard to try to find that experience, that pleasure, but never really find it, because the real, what we're really seeking is within ourselves. So a great person who is actually experiencing, seeing God, loving God, and feeling God's love, to that person, it's not just an intellectual exercise. That person can't tolerate seeing people cheating themselves without it. So in a very compassionate and loving way, simply want to share that with others. So that was his spirit. So his destination was New York City. He had no money. When he left India, he had what was equivalent to $7. Now, how many of you would go abroad with $7? But it was in rupees, 40 rupees. Years later, when he returned to India, he still had the same 40 rupees, because no one in America in 1965 wanted to even see the sight of a rupee, because it was worthless. So he actually came with nothing. He was on a cargo ship called Jaladuta. And as it was crossing the Arabian Sea, he had three heart attacks, major heart attacks. And there was no medical facilities. It was a cargo ship, not a luxury liner. It was a cargo ship. When he arrived in New York City, after a month of heart attacks, seasickness, he didn't know anybody. He was living in the Bowery. At that time, the Bowery was the most infamous ghetto in all of America. Now, those are obstacles. He was 70 years old with no one. But every obstacle that came upon him just gave him more strength, more enthusiasm, and more courage. Even though there was another obstacle, people of India he was asking help of, they were writing him and saying, what you're trying to do is impossible. Just come back. It's impossible. So he was alone. But because he pursued, now for his followers and followers of all generations, that is one of the greatest characteristics that make us love him. Is he went through all those hardships, all those difficulties, and all those almost impossible hardships just to give us something wonderful. Within a few years, he had 108 temples. Now there's about 600. He came with a little suitcase full of books. Within a few years, tens and millions of books that he had wrote were being distributed and read all over the world. So yes, great people, both in sports, in business, politics, even in science. Thomas Edison he did horrible in school. He had defect in his hearing. He couldn't hear properly. And he wasn't very good in his studies. He was less than mediocre. His parents took him out of school when he was about 10. Something like that. He did home study. And he failed, I think, about 800 times. 875, something like that, experiments failed before he actually succeeded in inventing the light bulb. And when he was asked by a newspaper reporter, before he actually invented it, so many failures, they said, you know, why do you keep going? He said, with every failure, I gain a great wealth of knowledge. I learn one more thing that doesn't work. How do you know? It's positive thinking. He was inspired by every failure. He was enthused because he learned something. This won't work. Now I know it. That means I'm that much closer to success. So yes, in every field, our greatness will be by how we overcome obstacles in a very positive spirit. And actually, this subject is the environment in which Bhagavad Gita was spoken. I think some of you come to the Bhagavad Gita study group. Yes, how many of you go to the Bhagavad Gita study groups? And how many go to cooking classes? In the Bhagavad Gita study group, you're studying a great scripture which was actually orchestrated in a situation of great obstacle. Here is Arjuna. He's a family man with wife and children. He's a statesman, military by profession. And he was representing dharma, or truth, piety, and spirituality. On the other side, there was Duryodhana, who was actually the ruling king, who exploited the Pandavas, exploited them of everything they had by illegal cheating means. He was trying to kill them, cheat them, deprive them of life itself. He represented greed, envy, pride, and there were two armies on that battlefield. One represented truth, one illusion. One represented religion, one irreligion. One represented benevolence and humility, the other pride, envy, and greed. Now Arjuna was between the two armies, and he became completely confused. He wanted to give up his duty altogether and just run away. He didn't want to be a part of this. Now for a military person who's a commander-in-chief of an army, this is a pretty big obstacle. When you lose all conviction, when you lose all hope, and he became so delirious that he was practically paralyzed. His body became pale. His mouth became dry. Tears were flowing from his eyes. His bow fell from his hand. And he turned to Krishna, who was on the chariot with him. It's a long and wonderful story of the events that led to this situation. At that point, he turned to Krishna. He was completely bewildered and overcome internally. And externally, the army against him was almost twice as big as the army that he had. So there was obstacles from both without and within. And then he turned to Krishna and said, please enlighten me. And Bhagavad Gita was 700 verses explaining how to overcome obstacles. Not only theoretically and philosophically, but practically. Bhagavad Gita teaches that in life, the obstacles that come from outside of us can actually be overcome very easily. The difficult obstacles are those that are within. If you can conquer your own mind, you've conquered the world in one sense. Because within our own mind, we have these opposing conditions. We have our moral side and our immoral side. We have our passions, and then we have also the voice of what is good. Yes? There's pride, and then there's the side of us that invokes us to humility. Part of us wants to just rip someone apart, and the other part wants to forgive them and be kind to them and be friends to them. Yes? These dualities are there. The heart is like a battlefield. And the soul, the person within the heart, is like Arjuna. And Bhagavad Gita is there to teach us how to conquer ignorance, illusion, and all the inclinations that are born of those qualities. How to nourish our godly nature. That is the greatest need in the world today. As we were speaking last time I was here, there is so much technology, so much science, so much development, even in the economy, various parts of the world. But is the world actually a better place to live than it was 100 years ago? The crime rate's going up, the suicide rate's going up, the drug addiction's going up, the alcoholism is going up per capita. There's so much pollution in the ecology of the world, so much pollution of the ecology both within people's hearts and minds, as well as within the water, the air, the earth. Is the quality of life actually improving along with all of our science and technology? Just by a practical, objective analysis? No. We were discussing in the 1960s and 50s when I was going to school, the biggest problems, according to the U.S. government, was running in the halls, talking in class, and putting gum under the desk. Those were big problems. Now, if you do that, you're considered a saint. In the 1990s, the biggest problems were guns, shootings, teenage pregnancy, and drug addiction. Does that tell something about the quality of the life? Yes. The fast rate and the fast pace that everything's happening, people are in great anxiety. We didn't hear about children killing each other with guns in school like we did a few years ago. How is that happening? What's happening to people? What's happening to the very moral, basic fiber of this nation and all of the world? That's a serious question. So we're not talking about a sectarian campaign to recruit people from one religion to another. We're speaking about basic spiritual principles that are very much lacking in the world today. Real principles. That is what Bhagavad Gita teaches. Apuryamanam achalapratishtam. Gita explains, when there's actual happiness, when there's actual peace within the heart, then nothing of this world can actually disturb that. Because it's so deep. Otherwise, whatever happiness, whatever contentment, whatever fulfillment we have, it is like little puddles, and anything can disturb that. How many things could go wrong at any given moment? Can anyone count? How many things could potentially go wrong and cause you anxiety at any moment? The ceiling could fall in, somebody could drop a bomb, somebody can insult us. Mosquito can bite us. We could get sick. There's unlimited things that could go wrong. So how to find actual happiness in a situation where at any moment so many ways could spoil everything, by actually finding joy, peace, and love within ourselves. And then through whatever we do, to share that, to express that through our occupation, to express that through our studies, to express that through every aspect of our life. That is what is great, most needed in the world today. And yes, to even consider this proposal to be important, there are so many obstacles. Yes? There's the obstacle of basic spiritual laziness. Yes? That we're just so active and so dynamic and so hardworking in our pursuit of material gain that we just don't give proper time to nourish our internal spirituality. That's a great obstacle. It's one of the greatest obstacles of all time, is just our own laziness. We just don't want to give the time. We don't want to give the energy because we don't see immediate results. Yes? The proper vision for the future is very much important. Look at the world today. So much madly rushing for immediate results. You know, solar ice caps are melting. There's so much pollution in the environment. And what's happening to people's children? It's very, very difficult. Intelligence is not only to see the immediate needs, but also to look into the future. And is spirituality important in life? If we are convinced that it is, then we must give time to nourish it and to cultivate it by proper association, by proper education, and by proper practice, to actually purify the heart, to actually purify the mind, to actually go deeper and deeper, to experience the inner wealth of the treasure of our own souls. It's so very important. So yes, this is a great obstacle. No time. Just like our Gurudev, he saw in a newspaper in Montreal where a wife is telling her husband, chant, chant, chant. And the husband is saying, can't, can't, can't. I do not have time. That is the condition. We have so much time for everything but the real needs of the self. There's a simple example of a lady who had a bird in a cage. And she was very, very busy decorating that cage. She put so much time and energy into decorating that cage. It was a beautiful cage. And one of her friend neighbors came to the house. She said, I want you to see my bird cage. The person looked at the cage. They were horrified. So what's wrong? So the cage is beautiful, but the bird is dead. You forgot all about the bird. You've been so busy decorating the cage, you forgot the bird inside. The whole purpose of the cage is to be a nice place for the bird. Now, this is a simple story, but it's the story of life for most of the population of the world today. We're putting so much time and so much energy in superficial external needs and wants, but very much neglecting our own consciousness. This is a universal principle. The Bhagavad Gita speaks very, very deeply in the science of the nature of consciousness. What is the difference, and what is the oneness and the difference between the soul and the body, between the soul and the world, between the soul and the Supreme Soul or God? What are the relationships? To understand them means to understand life in truth, as it is, in reality. Otherwise, we work so hard for the cage, but we totally forget and neglect the needs of the person. That is a great obstacle. Another great obstacle in spirituality is trying to deal with the propaganda of society around us. Just like we're vegetarians. And in India, there are millions and millions of pious people who are vegetarians. I know one very nice religious man, devotee, and he's an international businessman and a very, very successful one as well. So he has to travel all around the world, and usually when you do business deals with people, they invite you to have dinner in some restaurant. Yes, that's the way it's done sometimes, from what I understand. They can't just say, no, I'm not coming with you. But they're vegetarians. And they inquired for me, this one man, that it's very embarrassing because nobody else is a vegetarian. And they look at me like there's something wrong, there's something strange. So what should I do? Because people are by nature concerned with popular opinion. People by nature want to fit in. Like in the 1960s, we had the counterculture. Have you ever heard of that? Counterculture was another name for the hippie movement. They were going against the culture. They were actually very, very proud and bold to go against the society, to be different, dress different, wear their hair different, sing different songs, get intoxicated in a different way. Everything they wanted to be different. But the problem was they created their own counterculture. And then you wanted to fit in and be accepted by those people. Yes? So it's very, very important that we're accepted by our peers. We're accepted by the society around us. In the Bible, Jesus said, if the world loves you, then you're against me. Because if the world loves you, that means you must not be following me. That's a universal principle. Lord Buddha, when he first began his mission, people thought he was crazy. People persecuted. That's why Buddhists, they're the best martial artists. Yes? In the Buddhist countries, karate and jiu-jitsu and so many other ones that I'm not aware of. But they come from these countries because the Buddha's monks were persecuted. They were beaten. They were abused because they were so different. So they developed these very, very scientific arts of self-defense. Yes? So this big industrialist was saying, what do I do when I sit at the table and everybody else is eating meat and I ask for a salad? And they say, Actually, in due course of time, people will respect. First they'll laugh at you. Then they may even feel threatened by you. But in course of time, they will respect you because they see that you live by what you believe in, even if they may not even understand it so much. So if we really want to overcome obstacles in a proper way, we must be convinced of what is truth, what is of real value, and live by that, with compassion, with forgiveness, and with kindness toward all living beings. There's nothing that intelligent people are more turned off by than judgmentalism. Yes? I'm going to heaven, and you're going to hell. I remember once I was at Ohio State University giving some talk, and somebody was very strongly saying like this to me. I was sitting in the lawn. He was an evangelist. We love all spiritual people who follow their path genuinely. But there's universal spiritual principles that must be appreciated. If we're not experiencing it in our own religion, we're not going to see it in others either. And that's really the cause of sectarianism, right? Just like if a master comes home and the dog of that master sees him coming sometimes in a three-piece suit. Yes, sometimes sees the master in pajamas. Sometimes sees the master in bathing suit, right? The dog will recognize his master. So if we can't recognize our God as he appears in different times and different places under different circumstances throughout history, that means what is really the quality of our knowledge and love for God? So intelligent people are very turned off by this judgmentalism. So I was sitting on the lawn, and I was just doing some chanting and speaking to some people, and this person had about 500 people around him, right? Because he was telling everyone they were going to hell for everything he saw in them. And they asked, well, what is that person, that Hare Krishna, where is he going? To hell! So then they said, well, why don't you tell him? So he came, and all 500 people came with me. He said, you are going to hell. I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to heaven. I said, well, if you're going to heaven, I'd probably be happier in hell. If heaven is full of such hateful, vengeful, judgmental people, then hell's probably a better place. And I asked the crowd, where would you rather be? And they all said, to hell, to hell. Like that. I said, well, why am I going to hell? I said, because you believe in a false god. I said, well, why do you say false god? I said, Krishna's false god. I said, well, do you know what Krishna means? He said, no. I only know he's a false god. I said, well, should I tell you? Krishna means all attractive. Is your god attractive? He said, yes. I said, is your god the source of all knowledge? Yes. Of all wealth? Yes. Of all strength? Yes. Of all beauty? Yes. Of all wealth? Yes. That means your god's all attractive. So that means your god is Krishna. Krishna means the all-attractive. He said, that's what Krishna means? I said, yes. And then he looked at me and said, Hare Krishna. So yes, people are very judgmental today. But when we actually live by what we believe is true, with a proper philosophy, with proper logic, with proper reason, and when we live by our convictions, even when other people laugh and other people criticize, what happens? We actually gain such deep insight and spiritual strength. And a couple years later, the same man told me that all the people that he does business with all over the world that he has lunch with actually respect him. They feel that he has integrity. And he said, it helps my business tremendously because they trust me. They're willing to do business with me more than others because they see that I'm a man of principle. I'm a man with inner depth. I'm a man with integrity. Integrity means to do the right thing even when it's very difficult. That's really what integrity is about. When there's so many obstacles, so many temptations, so many difficulties that confront you, and in the face of those obstacles, it's so easy to compromise. It's so easy to sell out what you believe is true. It's so easy to sell out ethics, morality, and your spiritual principles. To follow them in the face of such obstacles is actually integrity. And when people see integrity, they actually develop faith. So do not allow obstacles to dissuade you. Be convinced of what you really want in life and pursue it with determination. In my own life, when I took to this particular religious path, it was so confusing to my parents. They were broken-hearted. What in the world are you doing? My mother, my poor mother, she thought I would die if I didn't eat meat every day due to lack of protein. That was 34 years ago. I'm still alive. So many problems they were having. Seeing that I was following something that was so fundamentally different. But because I pursued it, after a few years, my mother and father, they became so proud they would come to India. They came to your house. Do you remember how nice they were? They were so happy. They were crying in happiness. At the beginning, they were crying in confusion. At the beginning, they were crying like, what has happened? They were just, we failed as parents. But after a few years, when they saw how when one pursues his ideals and his ideals are good, when one actually pursues the ideal of nourishing inner spiritual qualities and devotion, my mother said to me, I am so proud of you. They were crying. They said, we are so proud of you. They started chanting Hare Krishna. They started buying books. They started putting Krishna in their house. They started distributing books to relatives. Arivo, how did that happen? Not because I'm great, because I'm just trying to serve. But even if a small person, even a very small person, just lives by his or her convictions and maintains his or her ethics, morality, and spiritual principles in a kind and generous way without judging others, then gradually people recognize that and have such very, very deep appreciation. Krishna says in Gita, what tastes like nectar in the beginning tastes like poison in the end. And what tastes like poison in the beginning tastes like nectar in the end. So we must look into what is really the highest, most enriching purpose of life, and to harmonize our spiritual principles with every aspect of our lives. And to the degree we nourish our spiritual nature with faith and realization, that gives us a power millions of times beyond our own to overcome all obstacles. It is a fact. And the most glorious experience of life is when we could feel that energy of something, and or let us say someone, far beyond ourselves, working through us to overcome obstacles that would be impossible for ourselves. Recently, I was with one of my very, very dear friends. His name is Shyam Sundar. I introduced him to you once, Ajay. Shyam Sundar was living in San Francisco. And he became one of the first devotees of our society in America. Just an ordinary person. And he decided that I'm going to make the Beatles devotees. Have you ever heard of the Beatles? They're still popular these days. In those days, they were unbelievably popular. They were setting the trend for the whole Western world of the young generation. Whatever they said became like the religion of our generation. Whatever way they dressed or wore their hair became the fashion of our generation. Yes, they were very powerful. I don't think there's anything like that today, is there? The cultural impact that they had on their generation, I don't know will ever happen again. It's unbelievable. And to see them, to meet them, was impossible. They were the most popular people in the whole Western world. And from what Ajay says, even India, even he was listening. The other side of the world. So his idea, because he saw Prabhupada, he started with nothing. He was a 70-year-old man who looked in New York to be just nothing but an old beggar practically. He was living in the Bowery. He had nothing. He had no support. He had no money. He had no facility. He had nothing. But he had faith in a power beyond his own. And therefore he pursued, and incredible things happened. And Prabhupada would always tell us, I'm not doing anything. I'm just allowing the energy of the compassion, the love of God to flow through me. And therefore, what Prabhupada used to say, impossible, is a word in a fool's dictionary. Pretty well. So this devotee Shyamasundara thought, if Prabhupada could do what he's done, I could make the Beatles Krishna conscious. So he went to London. And the biggest people from all over the world were trying to meet them, and they couldn't. And somehow or other, by some power beyond his own, he was living in the house of George Harrison, the lead guitar player of the Beatles, and helping him write songs. And George became a wonderful devotee and wrote beautiful songs that introduced the Maha Mantra to millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people all over the world. And just a few years ago, he left this world with the beautiful deities of Radha and Krishna and devotees chanting around him. Wonderful. And this Shyamasundara, I was just with him a few days ago. George always said he was his best friend because he trusted him. Because there's so many big people around. When you become big and famous like this, so many people want to know you and be with you and be seen with you. But he trusted Shyamasundara so deeply as his best friend because he understood he really cares about me. He really cares about my heart, my soul, and my life. And therefore he wanted these devotees to be with him at the time of his departure from this world. And Shyamasundara Prabhu was telling me like this. Yes, unlimited obstacles. But where there's faith, where one is enthused by the spiritual energy of the soul, by the spiritual energy of God within our heart, we can do incredible things. Incredible good things. These terrorists and these fanatics, that has nothing to do with God. It has nothing to do with spirituality. It has nothing to do with religion. It is simply imposing their own bigoted egos upon the name of religion. That's all. The universal principle of spirituality is compassion, forgiveness, love, and devotion. And when we have faith in these principles, yes, we can overcome all obstacles. In fact, the more obstacles, the more wonderful and exciting life becomes, because we can see energies beyond our own working. There's a very nice story. How many of you have heard of Hanuman? Hanuman was a very powerful devotee of the Lord, of Lord Ram. Hanuman was, they were building a bridge across an ocean. And he was lifting huge, gigantic rocks, practically peaks of mountains. He was so strong, he was just lifting. And as he was doing like this, there was one little spider kicking grains of sand, trying to help. And Hanuman was carrying a big stone, and he said, "Get out of my path, spider." And Ram told Hanuman that, "Never speak like that. He is doing as much as you. He's doing everything he could for the sake of virtue, for the sake of devotion to God, and you're doing as much as you could do." Now, Lord Ram was an avatar of God. Ram said, "In my eyes, I see you are both equal because you are both doing what you can sincerely. I do not see the physical result of what's done. I see the heart. I see the purpose in which everything is done. That is actually the success of our life. That is what will bring real happiness and will bring great things to the world. Because that is what pleases the Supreme. What is the nobility, the integrity, and the sincerity of the purpose in which we do whatever we do? That is actually success. The physical results, they don't please God. Whether we get them or don't, whether we're a spider or whether we're Hanuman, everyone could be satisfied just knowing that they're doing the best they can to live with spiritual integrity. But yes, to do that in this world, there are so many obstacles coming from without and within. And Bhagavad Gita teaches, with faith, with cultivation of spiritual awareness, we can very easily overcome all obstacles and become glorious. We should never give up. What we treasure is sacred and holy in our lives. We should never give up. If a crippled girl with polio could be the fastest woman in the world, we can understand that the only real obstacle is our own unwillingness to pursue our ideals and goals with full enthusiasm and never ever be discouraged. Would anybody like to speak any comments or ask any questions?
What verse did you cite in the middle of your talk?
About the ocean? About the inner satisfaction?
Yeah.
That is the last verse of the second chapter. Apuryamanam achala pratishtam. Yes.
When we're on our paths and overcoming our obstacles, what's the best way to deal with the humanity of them? Because we have a material side as well as a spiritual side. And while it seems impossible to completely overcome the material side, I once read in the Aquarian Gospel that it said our lower nature should be made to serve our higher nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, part of being human, I feel like, is to feel a sort of despair when we overcome an obstacle, and then immediately see an even bigger one in front of us, as soon as we got over our last one. So, it's a good way to deal with that, the basic human despair, that sometimes we feel like disconnected from God, sometimes we feel like we'll never fully get there. On your quest, how did you deal with it when you were even younger?
It is the most important question, thank you. We are human beings. Essentially, we are eternal spiritual souls. We are divine consciousness, which is temporarily residing within a human body. But as we're living in a human body with a human mind, we're very much influenced and limited, in one sense, by that. So the Bhagavad Gita does not teach us to reject or neglect our human nature, but rather to channel that same humanity that you're speaking of in harmony with the needs and the interests of our spiritual nature. We do not want to simply reject our human tendencies, but we want to purify our human tendencies by expressing them in a healthy spiritual direction. Yes? Just like one human tendency is to eat. Yes? In fact, every species of life, that's a main priority. It's somehow or other eating. And for human beings, eating is very important. In fact, New York City is the most famous place in the world for restaurants. People like to eat. Whether you're rich or poor, whether you're learned or illiterate, whether you're Anglo-Saxon or African or Asian or Indian or man or woman, young or old, it's a human need to eat. Yes? So we can't give up eating. Some people try. Some yogis, I used to live with a yogi who just lived on air. He could actually derive all nourishment simply by breathing air. But the amazing thing is, although he gave up eating, he had a big false ego. I was thinking he would probably be more spiritual if he ate something and got humble. So It's a human need to eat. So we could eat in a way that's harmonious and beneficial to our spirituality, or we can eat in such a way that is counterproductive. Yes? It's like very soon we will be getting prasad, which is very, very pure spiritual food cooked with great devotion, not for money, because what the cook, when a cook prepares, that person's consciousness is within the food. It's like people like home cooking, because usually the mother cooks with love for their family. In restaurant, it might taste better in one sense, but they're just cooking with desire for money. Yes? And when we actually eat such pure vegetarian food and we spiritualize it through our prayer, then it becomes very, very purifying to the heart and very beneficial to our spiritual life. So that is a way of channelizing the human need to eat or the human want to eat in such a way that it elevates us rather than degrades us. Yes? It is said, you are what you eat. Leonardo da Vinci, the great artist of Italy, he said, when man becomes civilized, he will understand that killing an animal to eat it is sinful like killing a man. We look at his artwork, but we don't really want to listen to what he says. But that's what inspired him to create such beautiful art. His love for humanity, his love for God. So similarly, we may have certain passions, and there are spiritual ways by which we can express those passions so that they uplift us rather than degrade us. And that's really the art of living. That's really the art of spirituality, to learn how to dovetail our human propensities in a way that is elevating to the soul and purifying to the heart. To learn how to dovetail and express our human nature in such a way that we free ourselves from karma rather than implicate ourselves in karma. Does that answer your question? But the idea of bhakti means devotion. It's really the most fundamental, basic human instinct is to love and be loved, is it not? It's like a little baby. A little baby doesn't have such intellectualization to want to, you know, which field of education he wants to go, which career. The little baby, why does the baby cry? Sometimes the baby cries because they're in pain, but usually the baby cries because it wants attention. Yes? And what is that crying for attention? It's the natural human instinct of the baby wants to be loved. For him or for her, that attention is a type of love that the baby enjoys, that the baby needs desperately. And as we grow, you know, that basic need becomes more complex because the mind becomes so much developed with so much other experiences and conditionings in this world. But really, that's the fundamental basic human need, to love and be loved, is it not? And all of our other needs are very much inseparable to that. So bhakti means don't destroy your sentiments, don't destroy your inclinations, but just learn how to use them all in harmony with the real well-being of your heart, your soul. Utilize whatever inclinations you have and whatever natural sentiments you have and whatever also intellectual prowess you have in such a way that's pleasing to God rather than just giving it up or trying to give it up, which is very, very difficult. Is there any other questions or comments? Yes.
One of the objectives is to leave behind this material body, human form, and merge with the transcendental. I find that this kind of reasoning very strange, because I can't think of going wanting to alleviate my suffering is some kind of a selfish, appears to be some kind of selfish thing to me. If there is suffering, I should accept suffering. If there is happiness, I should accept happiness. I should not want otherwise. So trying to alleviate my sufferings by merging with God doesn't seem like seems very selfish. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree. There are different states of God realization. The idea of merging into God or entering into the all-pervading oneness beyond this temporary existence is a very preliminary, partial understanding of God realization. That type of mukti or salvation or nirvana is to be completely free of the sufferings of this world and to just enter into a state of total peace, where really you're non-existent as far as a personality. You're simply resting in an atmosphere of utter peace. Yes? But a higher realization of the Absolute is love. What is higher, peace or love? To some people, they may want peace. But actually, peace is the negation of all disturbances. It's like when you fall asleep, you're peaceful because you forget everything. If you have a nightmare, then it's different. But when you're just sleeping, it's very peaceful because everything is forgotten. Or where you go into a deep state of meditation, you just enter into a state where you just become oblivious to the world, there's peace. And that is a spiritual realization, that type of peace. But a more complete and full spiritual realization is love, prema. Prema is ecstatic. It's actually a higher ecstasy to suffer for your beloved than to be in peace. Because even in suffering for, on a spiritual platform, suffering for God is actually an expression of very, very deep love. And it transcends and goes beyond even the peace of oneness. So yes, we should understand that the real craving of the heart is for this love, spiritual love. And the sufferings of this world, we can't say honestly that we don't mind them. Because when you get sick, do you take medicine? That means you really don't like the suffering. And you are fighting against it. When you're hungry, do you eat? When you're thirsty, you drink?
I try to cure, but I accept that it is my condition. So I can't.
Yes, but at the same time, you're trying. Why do you work? If you really didn't mind poverty, you wouldn't be working so hard. Yes? I mean, we have to be honest. We don't like to suffer. And in this world, we are trying to battle against suffering in so many ways in life. We get a nice car because we don't like the crowded subways. We do so many things because we're trying to counteract suffering. It's our nature to not want to suffer. But actually, you know, the real solution to counteract that suffering is not simply all of the various adjustments we're making within our life, which we have to do. It's human. It's human that if you're sick, you want to get better, whether it's natural cure or whether it's chemical cure. It's our human nature that if we're sick, we want to get better. It's our human nature if there's an inconvenience, we want to create some basic comfort. Yes, there's nothing wrong with that. But we should understand that really the state of consciousness beyond suffering is the transcendental consciousness of being one with our soul, of being conscious of who we really are and our relationship with the Supreme. So while living in this world and dealing with the human aspect of life, we should be cultivating that inner enlightenment, that inner spiritualization. We should be striving to come closer to being in harmony with God in everything we do, everything we say, and everything we think. Does that answer your question? Is there any other questions?
Well, it's during our study group discussions, you know, we are kind of struggling with this too. It seems that most of our struggle with these questions, you know, they start the moment we take the human form, like the moment we are born, and then this struggle with the worldly means versus your spirituality, which takes place. But I've been feeling that, you know, when Krishna says it to the Arjuna, you know, Krishna is standing on a kind of higher pedestal, you know, I mean, who doesn't have those kind of bondings which, mortal means, I mean, the people like us, we have. So once we take these, once we are born, we would inherit all these things, and then the struggle begins, you know. And it doesn't seem to be a level playing field, what we call in this modern day, you know.
Can you translate that modern day?
Which means that it's not fair, you know, that you have Krishna, you know, who actually doesn't have all these bondings and all these, you know, the worldly, you know, the problems. I mean, it's easy for Arjuna, it's not easy said than done, you know. I mean, he has to virtually now endure all those theories on himself. But for Krishna, it's just a mere discourse, you know. So how do you kind of reconcile this? I don't know if this is a question or it's a comment, but this is something which I even raised in one of our class discussions, but we reserved it for you.
You're from Columbia University?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Gadadhar Pandit warned me about you.
You also have to be like a lost lawyer. Yeah.
But he warned me very affectionately also. Let me ask you this question. If you're sick and a doctor who's in good health comes to give you medicine and tell you how to get back to health, is that unfair? Same thing. Arjuna was sick. Arjuna was sick. He was suffering due to ignorance. And due to that ignorance, all of these other complications of materialistic bondage were affecting him. Yes? And Krishna's a liberated, Krishna's God. He's eternally liberated. And he comes down like a doctor to give Arjuna, in Bhagavad Gita, he gives him his diagnosis. Asochan, in the second chapter, he says, Arjuna, you're in ignorance. Your disease is ignorance. You're lamenting in such a way because of your foolishness. Because you're identifying yourself with something that you're not. Yes? So he gives the diagnosis, and then he gives the medicine and the way to take the medicine. It's not unfair. It's compassion. It's love. It's mercy. The absolute truth is so kind and so loving that the absolute truth descends to this world again and again and again and again in various ways and various times to teach us how to come out of our suffering condition and how to actually find the real treasure of happiness and love that we're searching for in our life. But we're just searching in the wrong places. Is that unfair? Do you hate the doctor because he's not sick like you? Huh? If you're starving and somebody comes with food, is that an imbalance? That why you have food and I don't? No, he does have and he's giving it to you. That's kindness, that's love, that's compassion. Today is Easter. Jesus Christ is an avatar of the Lord who descended into this world to teach people. Jesus said that make your treasure not in this world, because in this world your treasure will be either stolen by thieves or eaten by moths, or corroded by rust, because everything's temporary. Make your treasure in the kingdom of God, because wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart will be. Yes? He taught these simple principles, spiritual principles, which are universal. He said, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. That's the law of karma. Krishna speaks about it in a very, very elaborate scientific explanation. But it's the same principle. The prophet Muhammad, he was a prophet of God. Now, just because some of his followers are not following properly, it doesn't mean that what he said was not good. It was the word of God, spoken according to time, place, and circumstance, to elevate people, to cure the disease of ignorance, of suffering. Yes? Lord Buddha, according to the Vedas, 2,500 years before Buddha came, the Vedas explain that the Lord will descend in Lumbini district as Lord Buddha and explained what his mission would be. And he came. People were slaughtering animals in the name of God in those days. And Buddha taught ahimsa, nonviolence. And he eradicated such violence. And he taught people inward peace and inward satisfaction and morality. Yes? Krishna comes in his original pure spiritual form from the spiritual world. He descends into this world. And he teaches Bhagavad Gita not to Arjuna. Actually, Krishna taught Bhagavad Gita to you, Siddhartha, to you. Because Arjuna was already a liberated soul. He just temporarily fell into illusion just so that Krishna could speak to you and me. Yes, and all of us. That's love, that's kindness, that's mercy. So if we're thinking, why, this isn't fair, you're in a different position than me. He's come, he's saying, come, come, come to your liberated condition. Come to your pure, blissful, loving nature. This is how. That's mercy. Does that answer your question? Honestly?
Yeah, honestly.
Thank you. Yes, Anand.
I wanted to ask that you were saying that what determines the character of man is how he overcomes obstacles. Now, I'm at a stage in my life where, you know, I'm still exploring and observing other people and how they overcome obstacles and how they deal with them. Now, certain obstacles are not built by human beings, by, you know, people who have to overcome them, but by other things. Such as, for instance, having lived in India, you see, you know, a certain amount of red tape that has been created over the years. And sometimes, you know, you have to, in business or, you know, even in school, that you see some people, you know, who do a little wrong to do a great right, ultimately. What do you think that in our modern day world, sometimes you don't have to compromise in a macro way your values, but sometimes, you know, you have to do a little here and there to achieve something greater. What do you think of that? Is it sometimes worth in business or, you know, in college itself, when you see people, certain people who pay their way and give big donations to universities? And, you know, you see other people who don't, and some people say that, okay, they're fools because, you know, everyone does. But what do you think?
Nice question, thank you. Being a sannyasi has its comforts in that we don't have to deal with those things. We must be honest. That is what is very important. Integrity is really an honest state of mind, a proper spirit and disposition. In this world, because there's so much cheating and so much corruption, sometimes just to survive in business or in politics or whatever, you can't avoid playing the game. Yes? If you want to be a brahmachari or a swami, then you don't have to play that game, because you're really just kind of you're not really within that society. You're kind of entering, but you're not involved. Because swamis don't have any money. At least they're not supposed to. And they just live very, very simple lives. So they don't really need anything. But in your type of situation, what's most important is to be very honest. And if you do have to cut the rules slightly, it should really be in a way that's not hurting others, and that genuinely is for the purpose of ultimately helping others. I'll give an example. I can give many examples, but here's an example. That a doctor is trained in the highest medical college of how to do surgery. What are the standards of sanitation? And what are the standards of creating an environment favorable for the surgery to be done properly? And that person's drafted in the army, and he's in the front lines, and somebody's shot. And that person has to do a major surgery in the front lines of a battlefield, right? There's no standards of sanitation. He just has to take a knife or a razor blade and cut the person open and gouge out the bullet and everything else because he has to save the person's life. Yes? So he's actually defying the standards of medical science. But to try to follow him in that situation would mean the person is dead. Yes? So the whole spirit of the medical technology is to save people's lives. Now, if that's actually your motive, sometimes in some types of emergency situations, to not follow the rules is better than following the rules. Yes? But it's not to kill the person. It's to save the person. So really, what is our ultimate goal? If we want to cheat people, if we want to be greedy, if we want to just pulverize different people, and we go and we bribe or we act unethically for that purpose, then all that karma comes upon us. Yes? But if we actually, honestly want to do something good, but to cut certain corners is the only way we can actually succeed and do this service, then that's a service to God. And it's acceptable. It's unfortunate, but that's the way the world is. I'll give an example. One great moralist of India, he taught ahimsa. He taught ahimsa, that nothing should ever be dealt with violence. So a journalist approached that person, very famous person, and said, "You're teaching ahimsa, nonviolence. Here is your daughter. If I attack your daughter physically, to violate her chastity, and the only way you can stop me is to physically beat me, would you do it?" What do you think his answer? He said, "Under no circumstance, for any reason, would I ever resort to physical affliction on someone." And the journalist turned to him, looked him right in the eyes, and said, "You are violent. To stand by and let me rape your daughter, that is violence. To physically stop me, even if it meant, that is nonviolence. It's an emergency." Yes? So yes, in India there's so much bureaucracy. Yeah, it's just more sophisticated here. And to try to play the rules and live by the laws is what we should do. But if sometimes some innocent ways of going around it to fulfill a higher purpose, sometimes it's acceptable. Sometimes it's necessary. It's unfortunate, but that's the way the world is. But really, we have to search our hearts and make sure that our motive and our goal is honest and we're not cheating anybody or hurting anybody doing it. That is all important. Does that answer your question?
No.
It's a very practical question. Yes?
Yeah, follow up on Anand's question. one of the things that I've experienced is that when you're working in corporate America, people have different motivations to work. And one's motivation is to do greater good. And it's kind of difficult to convey that concept to others when you're working, because people want to find shortcuts to get ahead in the game. And it takes tremendous amount of time and patience to eventually transform that person. Sometimes you're not successful. So transform the person in terms of get them to the path of righteousness. How would you decrease the cycle time to transform others so that you can eventually impact and touch more lives? Because we have such a limited amount of time.
The best way, in my opinion, is that your life's example of integrity and principle shines to give light to their lives. 1,000 sermons do not move a person's heart as much as somebody who's living by good example. Yes? I've seen simple housewives have a deeper impact on people's lives than big preachers. Because if you preach and you live with hypocrisy, we have seen what has happened. It actually ruins people's faith, threatens people's faith. When you have faith in someone and then you see they're hypocritical. Yes? You're speaking in the corporate world. You may not be able to give lectures to them. If you can actually instruct them in these principles, that's wonderful. But I don't know if you can do it. It's not possible. So the greatest thing you could do is live with the simplicity, the honesty, and the purity in your own life that your example is inspiring to others. When we were speaking to Anand, we shouldn't be corrupt. We shouldn't be cheaters. We should be as honest as possible. If it's absolutely an emergency, just to get something done so you could do good for the world, then you might be able to, you know, cut some of the bureaucracy aside. But we shouldn't be corrupt. We should be honest. We should be detached. We should understand that our values are more precious than any type of profit. If you think that your profits are more precious than the values that you hold sacred in your heart, then you're going to be selling out your principles day and night. Yes, because that's the way the world is. We have to have a strong foundation of value in our life. And then we could work hard, and we could be disciplined, and we could strive, and we could be successful, and we could be great, but on our terms, not on the terms of the corruption of this world. I have seen people become such wealthy people, hundreds of millions of dollars, but because they sell their values, they sell their ethics, they sell out all virtues to make it. There's such heaps of sinful karma upon them. There's such heaps of all the pain that they have caused to others, even killing sometimes. There's no peace. There's no happiness. There's no fulfillment inside. Their life is just a vastly decorated, hollow shell. That's their life. I may have told you the story of this one very, very famous top television star I met some years ago. And he was telling me about the life of the people in Hollywood. He said, I know them. I'm with them. I'm on the top with them. I'm mixing with the politicians, with the musicians, with the television stars, with the movie stars. He said, it's just their lives are hollow shells, but those shells are so vibrant and so opulent and so decorated and so attractive, and the whole world wants a shell like that, but they don't understand that there's practically nothing inside. Is that what we want? Is that what we want? If we want deep satisfaction, fulfillment, and meaning to life, then we have to live with integrity. That means we have to transcend those obstacles in the form of the allurement to be corrupt. That's one of the great obstacles. It's easy to succeed if you're corrupt in this world. And it's very difficult if you're honest. It's an obstacle. However, with faith, with spiritual discipline, our honesty can triumph and bring us to greater and greater to victories and success. But it takes a little patience, it takes perseverance, and it takes faith. And we should have the faith that without this, whatever success I have is meaningless. That was Arjuna's idea. That was one of his arguments in the second chapter. Doug, you were speaking from Bhagavad Gita, second chapter. Arjuna is speaking to Krishna, the first and second chapter. Even if I win this war, if it's at the expense of others, then I can't be happy. I'd rather lose. Right? I'd rather lose this war. I'd rather just give up right now than fight and win at the cost of the happiness of others, at the cost of creating immorality in this world. And that's true. If we actually have values in life, what's the use of... You win the battle, but you lose the war. The aim of everything we're doing in life is internal fulfillment, meaning, and satisfaction, and actually sharing that gift with our loved ones. That's what we live for. If we lose all that just to become big and famous and wealthy, then what have we done? Our life is wasted. You'll be buried in a $10 million coffin. So what? You're not going to be any happier in a $10 million coffin than if you're burned on the bank of the Ganges, are you? So yes, we must understand what is our... and be an example. The best thing we can do for the world is to be an example of faith and integrity. And know with the help of God, yes, we will cross all obstacles. Does that answer your question? Be honest, be humble, be hardworking, be sincere. Just like we have our Brajaraj. Does everyone know Brajaraj? Brajaraj comes from the highest school in all of India, IIT, Indian Institute of Technology. I believe every year there's 300,000 applications for enrollment, and they accept 2,000 people a year. Yes? So you have to really be a top student. In fact, on 60 Minutes television show, someone told me that there was a section where one big businessman, he was talking about his son. He said, IIT is so difficult to get into that my son could not get into IIT, so as a second choice, he went to Columbia University in New York. That's how difficult it is. And now he's in Columbia University, and he just took a test and got scholarship. 20 people a year get this scholarship. Very, very rare scholarship. When he was at IIT, he's a devotee of Krishna, and he's chanting Krishna's names every day, and he's living a very, very pure life. In the dormitories there, people are listening to rock and roll and they're drinking alcohol, yes? And they have girlfriends and boyfriends and they're doing so many things, watching televisions. And he wasn't doing any of that. He was just happy, just doing his studies, working very hard. And because he was living by such sacred spiritual principles in his personal life, so honest, so self-controlled, so deeply devotional, but at the same time he worked very, very hard in his studies, he made a very, very big impression on the students of that school. That you could be very successful, you could meet great, great horizons of success, even in your material life, and not compromise or sell your soul to the inferior ways of this world. That's a great example. To do wonderful things through your hard work and still maintain the dignity of the principles that you hold sacred in life. Yes?
Yeah, it's you talk about the second chapter and when Arjuna said that However, I think that Krishna told him at this very moment that he had to perform his duty even though a lot of loss could result. How can you resolve this contradiction? Doesn't it mean, isn't it also kind of a way to say that, when you have to do something, and what things are valuable enough or justifiable to allow this loss to happen? I mean, how can we solve this contradiction? You seem to say that those people in Hollywood or wherever, they had nothing in the end, or some successful businessman that had perhaps two people or whatever they had to do to get this wealth. But it seems that in the Bhagavad Gita, they say we have a duty to perform it, whatever loss may happen. How can we solve this contradiction of being integral, having this integrity, and being faithful to, all those universal principles of goodness towards people, and at the same time having this hand of incentive given by Krishna?
Thank you. Very insightful question. I didn't say that about the people in Hollywood. Just Hollywood starts said it about. I'm just quoting him.
You can also, imagine that such things happen. We all have our beliefs of what happens in politics and whatever. Some people die, some people kill each other. So everyone has these kind of perceptions. So no matter, what is the example, I just want to know how this.
In regard to the Gita, we must understand really what is the background to the environment that faced Arjuna. Arjuna proved to Krishna and proved to the world that he wasn't interested in winning the war. He wasn't interested in the material benefits of winning the war. He wasn't doing it for himself. He was defending Dharma. He was actually protecting the innocent. Because Duryodhana was simply demoniac. It's something like when... It's crude. It's not exactly like this. But if Hitler comes marching into your country with all of his military and he's killing millions of innocent people, is it your duty, if you're a military person, to fight against him? Yes? You're fighting against him not because you want to conquer Germany, because you want to protect innocent people from the onslaught of his sinful deeds. Yes? Well, Duryodhana was something like that. He was envious, he was cruel, he was cheating, he was murderous, he was king, and he was doing all kinds of illegal and immoral things, and he was leading the world in the wrong direction. Yes? Krishna wanted Arjuna to fight this battle to protect the innocent people in the world and to reestablish goodness, rather than Duryodhana established envy, pride, and greed in this world. That's the way he ruled. Yes? So it wasn't for his own purposes.
So his own beliefs are the right one against the other. So which kind of duty is right? Which kind of duty is not? What is justifiable and what is not? What are the criteria? How can you know that you're in the right path? And that you're not blurred by your own illusion, that your own belief is the right one against the
other. That is why Arjuna needed Krishna to tell him, because he was confused. So similarly, there are scriptures in this world, there are saints in this world, there's also people who are in the guise of saints who are not saints. But if we're sincere, we must actually understand what is right and what is wrong, not simply by what we feel, but on the basis of truth, which is descending. Yes? Every nation or every part of the world has holy scriptures. They have saints. Yes? Proper gurus. Guru means one who removes darkness from our life. And what is the darkness? Ignorance. We really don't know. We all have our conceptions. What we thinking is good for the world might be very damaging to the world. And as you say, everybody has their opinion and everybody believes that what they're thinking is right. Yes? And everyone justifies their actions according to their beliefs. So what is the standard? Is the standard of what's good and what's wrong, what's truth and what's illusion, is that standard just whatever everybody feels? I'm sure that Hitler, in killing all those millions of Jews, was justified everything he did with thinking, this is going to be the best thing for the world. Yes? I'm sure he did. And he convinced practically the whole nation, which is incredible. By his charisma, he convinced practically the whole nation. I have one very, very dear friend, and his father was one of the officers of the Nazi army in the RS. And he was actually there going into Russia and killing innocent men, women, and children. Just killing them. Defenseless. The only fault they had in their life was the religion that they followed. And he was absolutely convinced that this is cleansing the world of evil. That this is the most humanitarian activity that I could possibly do. Because Hitler convinced him. He had that power. Does that mean it's right because you're convinced of it? No. After the whole Nazi regime crumbled and Hitler just committed suicide underground, and all the dreams that they dreamt of having a world, one world order under them to make the world beautiful and like a heaven, when it all fell to pieces right before his eyes, then he realized that everything I did was wrong. His nightmares, regular, recurring nightmares of the people he killed coming back to destroy him. He suffers miserably to this day. I was cheated. I was duped. We justified everything thinking what we were right, but we were wrong. So what is the standard of right and wrong? It's not just our opinion or our conviction, because we can justify anything. Yes, we can justify anything. There's crazy people. I remember there was a crazy man who was shooting people from a tower. And when they finally caught him, he said that it was God who told me to do this. And psychiatrists actually examined him and came to the conclusion that he really believes that God was telling him to do this. Does that mean God was telling him to do this? No. It was his mind. It was his mind saying, I'm God telling you to do that. So that was the situation of Arjuna. That's what Bhagavad Gita is about. He was confused because internally he had so many alternatives, and externally the situation around him was so tense. So he turned to Krishna. Please explain to me what is the truth and what is actually my duty. And that is what a guru is supposed to do. A guru is supposed to remove the darkness of our ignorance, to actually see things as it is. But according to our sincerity, we should find the proper teachers and the proper path by which we can actually live by the truth and not by our own mind's whims. And what did Krishna teach Arjuna? What Krishna taught Arjuna is not that we should just do our duty, but we should do our duty in divine consciousness with the right morals, with the right principles, and the right values. That's what he teaches. And what are those right values? He teaches humility, tolerance, forgiveness, self-control, dedication, devotion. These are the qualities that we're meant to cultivate internally. And then you do your duty. Or simultaneously, as you're doing your duty in the case of people in this world, we must be cultivating these divine virtues within. For Arjuna, fighting that war was like a surgeon doing a surgery. He was actually purging society from a great disease that was causing so much pain and suffering. Yes? He was like a surgeon. A surgeon is violent. He's cutting flesh and there's blood flowing. Yes? But he's doing it for a good cause. And that good cause cannot just be our own impression. It has to be based on what's actually beneficial to the world. Does that answer your question? Somewhat. Thank you very much. Thank you. Very important question. Yes?
What is your conception of God and how do you send and receive the
Janmadya Shagataha. That's the absolute truth is from whom everything emanates. The source of everything that exists. That is God. Now, does everything come from something or does everything come from nothing? That's the argument between the theists and the atheists. The atheists say everything comes from nothing. Yes, everything is just come about by evolution without any intelligence behind it. And the theist conception is that there is a supreme origin of everything that exists, and everything is emanating from that supreme origin, and that origin is God. And Achintya, that is the nature of God. What is your name?
Yes.
Achintya. Achintya means inconceivable, that the absolute truth cannot be understood by simple rational intelligence. We can try to understand, but the limits of the inconceivable nature of God is something very, very inconceivable. Example, we were speaking at Ajay's house the other day, how people want to see miracles. Yes? There's people in India who could create ashes like this and get millions of followers because they could create ashes. I knew a couple people that could create ashes like this. It's just a supernatural power that they have. But that doesn't mean you're God. God does a lot more than that. Someone who can read your mind. Someone who could create gold. Just like this Prapti city. These are mystic powers. Just like there's magicians who know different tricks of how to make things appear that aren't really what you think you're seeing. Well, there's mystic yogis who can actually do that without any props. They can actually defy what we consider how nature works. But that's not a great thing. It just takes practice. Just takes practice. Practice in the science of mysticism, anyone could do that. May take this life or even a couple lives. Some people are born with it because of previous lives of practice. And we have seen. But actually, even when we saw it, we weren't really impressed by it. Because so what? You know, you could make a fire and get ashes. But the miracles that God is creating at every moment, we look at them and we don't even take note. It's so sad. At every moment of every day, we're seeing inconceivable miracles beyond all human abilities. In New York City, what is there, 8 million people? Every person is an incredible miracle. We just walk by, just dull-headed. You know, some people we say hi, and some people we don't look at all. What a miracle. There was a gynecologist, top gynecologist in India, at the lecture at Ajay's house and a nun's house. And do you remember we were discussing the miracle of life? A man and woman come together. They don't really know what's happening. They're just thinking it's pleasurable. And then a little seed comes from the man and goes into the woman. It's not that they're very systematically calculating how that seed's going to go in and what's going to happen. It's just happening. Sometimes they don't even want it to happen. But that seed gets emulsified in the woman's ovum and all of a sudden, life forms. Yes? Somehow or other, life enters into that very inconceivable, minute situation. And it starts growing. It starts growing. There has to be life to be growing. Dead things don't grow, do they? When a tree's alive, it grows. When a tree's cut down, it doesn't grow. A child doesn't grow when it's dead. Only when it's live. Where there's life, there's growth. So that little speck of a seed just starts to grow. And within that seed is all the potential of a human being. Is that incredible? Could any scientist do that? Could they put a fully developed human being into little seed? It's just happening naturally. And it's happening practically the same way all over the world. It doesn't matter if you're American Indian, or if you're European, or if you're African, or if you're Alaskan. It's happening the same way. It starts developing. And then eyes forms, and nose forms, and ears form, and mind forms, and the heart forms, and the brain forms, and the lungs form, and the kidneys form, and the liver forms, and the legs form, and the whole circulatory system forms, and all the veins form. It's the most complex machine there is. There's no computer that's as complex as a human body, is there? The brain? And within it is built the capacity to create other human beings without any other interference. Yes? We could think, we could see, we could feel, we could taste, we could smell, we could love. How did this body and all the experiences that this body provides come about? From a little seed with no one's attention, with no one's development. It just happens. Is that a miracle? Is that something greater than producing some ashes? Yes. Everywhere we see life, we see miracle. We're tasting, we're seeing. Every time we look, just the fact that these eyes provide a window for the soul to see the world. And how did these eyes develop? Where did they come from? It's a miracle. Yes? But we just look and we're just totally, usually just dull to the fact of the reality of what an incredible world it is. Yes? Now, when there's a water shortage in New York City, yes, they bring water trucks in. How much can a water truck carry? It's so difficult because water is heavy. Now, when God wants to bring water, well, let's not say God. Look at the clouds in the sky. What an incredible technology for moving water. It's a miracle. Now, one gigantic cloud could completely flood the city of New York. In Bombay, we've seen during the monsoon seasons, just one big cloud, that just one gigantic cloud that covers the city. Nobody makes it. It just, the sun evaporates water from the sea, and then the breeze, the wind kind of moves that gigantic cloud hundreds of miles and brings it to where you are. And one rain, Bombay is the wealthiest, most powerful city in all of India, and one rain could totally flood the city. Yes, you've seen Anand. It's waist high. The streets become rivers. The airport's closed. The railway system's closed. The phone lines close. The electrical lines close. Yes? Just from the quantity of water of one cloud. And yet, when all that water is in the cloud, before it starts raining, all those quadrillions of gallons of water are floating in the sky. All the water is in the cloud, but it's so light that it's floating in the sky. Now, we have our water towers, right? And you see how much engineering with, construction engineering is required to make a water tower. Steel beams and girders and cross sections and all these things just to keep that heavy mass of water high. The clouds have no beams. They're just floating lighter than the air, and there's trillions of gallons of water in it. And when it releases, as it comes down. Not only that, you could fly an airplane right through it, and the airplane doesn't even get wet. How is that possible? That's a miracle. Yes? That's God. Is it all happening accidentally? Or is there some intelligence behind it? Look at a mosquito. Now, we don't like mosquitoes, but I'll give you a different perception of mosquitoes. Now you just mosquito, you know, some people, if you're violent, you just whack them, and if you're nonviolent, you just go like this. But nobody likes mosquitoes. But what a miracle a mosquito is, even a gnat. I just came last night to JFK Airport from Venice with a stop in London. Now, we had to circumambulate the city about five times because there was no space in the runway for us to land. That's why the flight was late. And air traffic controllers are just always in anxiety about some crash. You know, if they're... And we're circumambulating. JFK is a massive airport with huge runways, circumambulating and circuit because there just wasn't space. And as soon as you go on the flight, I mean, if you take seriously what they say, it's very fearful. First they tell you about where the life raft is. I mean, if you need a life raft, if the plane goes down, how many people actually survive because of their life raft? You know, you blow in it like this. And there's a whistle on it, they teach you how to blow the whistle. I mean, if an airplane's going to crash, I don't know how many people were saved by that whistle and that little life raft. And they're showing you where the emergency exit is and how you should take off your high-heeled shoes when you're going down the chute. There's a lot of dangers in flying. But look at a mosquito. Absolute perfection of aerodynamics. Yes? Unbelievable. You can have thousands of mosquitoes under one light bulb and they'll never crash. And they don't have radar controls or anything like that. I've never seen two mosquitoes crashing. And I've actually looked under light bulbs and saw thousands of mosquitoes, and they just go, and they never crash. It's unbelievable. And they can land on the head of a needle. Absolutely perfect. Yes? And actually, when man invented the airplane, he studied the bird and the mosquitoes to see how God made flying instruments. And we're just trying to imitate, but we just can't do it the same way. And each mosquito has, you know, they're the pilot, they're the whole crew in one form. They could take off in a second, they could land anywhere. And look at, according to science, there's a mystery that's actually not possible, but we see it every day. And that's the bumblebee. Yes? According to aerodynamics, the bumblebees, the proportion of weight of the bumblebee's body compared to its wings, it's simply scientifically impossible for that bumblebee to fly. It can't be done. Yes? Such little tiny skinny wings that are just like fine tissue and this big hairy body that's so heavy. Can't. But the bumblebee doesn't pay attention to the scientist's conclusion. He couldn't care less what the scientist said. He flies. Perfect aerodynamics. Yes? How is it possible? It's happening by accident? We need years and years and years of aerotechnology to create an airplane, and thousands of times more proficient than any airplane are the insects and birds flying. How? It's the miracle of God with every bird, with every insect, with every tree. One little seed this big falls to the ground. But within that tree, within that seed, is the tree. Gigantic tree. New York, you have some very nice trees. In Central Park, I have seen beautiful big trees. but its origin was one little seed. How is it possible? Yes, there's so many miracles of God. Every blade of grass. So you were asking, what is this God? God is the source of everything. Even Albert Einstein, who's one of the most celebrated genius scientists in the world, his conclusion at the end of his life is the universe cannot possibly be what it is unless there is an intelligence behind it all. And what's his conclusion? That intelligence is what we call God, the supreme person, the supreme all-attractive person. So yes, the Lord is inconceivable and God is great, but how God is great is the greatest study in the world. Isaac Newton was one of the founders of science in the Western world. His idea of science was that we know God is great. The more we understand how material nature works, the more we'll appreciate the greatness of God. But what happened is somehow or other it became on a different track, and now we understand so much that we've come to the conclusion we don't need the idea of God anymore. We figured it out ourselves. But does it make sense? And that supreme achintya, inconceivable, miraculous Lord whose intelligence is behind this entire cosmic manifestation, descends within to this world to give us his avatars, to give us his holy scriptures, to inspire saintly people, to teach us who are we and what is our relationship with material nature and what is our relationship with the supreme, and to find the deep, infinite, ecstatic, inner joy and love of that relationship. Does that answer your question? Say what? Yes.
I wrote it down, so I'm just going to read it.
Please.
But regarding the notion of pleasure, being a psychology student, I've understood that this notion is the essence of motivation. So being convinced of the authority of the Bhagavad Gita, but still being attached to worldly enjoyment, I'm meddling in between spiritual and material paradigms. What could you tell us from the perspective of being a monk? What is real pleasure and how it differs from material pleasure?
Material pleasure is the temporary experiences of the senses, interaction with the objects of the senses, or the subtle sense of the mind in contact with the subtle objects of the senses. Just like we may touch something and feel pleasure. That gives us some happiness. Or we may think of something on a subtle level. We may think of a pleasure. I may touch somebody or I may be thinking of touching somebody. Yes? So that's an interaction of the mind through thought enjoying pleasure. So that is gross and subtle material enjoyment. Now, spiritual enjoyment is awakening the inner joy of the soul. Material enjoyment is trying to somehow or other, either through our mind or through our senses, find something outside of ourselves for happiness. Yes? Which is temporary and which never really fulfills our needs. And spiritual joy is actually awakening that oceanic experience of ecstasy that is within our own hearts. And what is that oceanic ecstasy? It is the dormant love of God that is within us. To awaken that is the true treasure of life. And with the great experience that we have through that, to share that experience with the world is the greatest charity, the greatest service, and is of great fulfillment to the heart.
Can we have both?
Can we have both?
Yeah.
Yes, we can have both. There is an art of having both. And that is by learning to use our mind and senses in ways by which it finds pleasure in harmony with the actual will of the soul, with the actual will of God. Yes? Just like you like to hear music, there's different types of music. If you listen to just relative music of the world, you'll get some pleasure. But how long will it last? After listening to a song a few times, you want to hear another song. It's like the number one song in 1967 you've never heard of today. Because how long do people like the same thing over and over and over again? You could chant apple, apple, apple and never taste apple. But in spiritual consciousness, when we chant the names of God, which we'll be doing in a few minutes, when you chant the names of God, you actually purify yourself and taste the sweetness of God. I know people who this Hare Krishna mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. They've been chanting this mantra for 50, 60 years. Some of these people do it for about 10 hours a day. And they're in ecstasy. They never go to their guru and say, give me a different mantra, I'm tired of that one. The more they chant it, the more they love it, the more it reveals deeper and deeper inner ecstasies of love. Yes? So yes, they're enjoying hearing a song, but it's a song that's illuminating their heart. Tasting food that illuminates our heart. Engaging in activities, just like we like to do work. We may be engineers, we may be lawyers, we may be business people, we may be monks, we may be housewives, we may be students, we may be architects, we may be farmers. But if our motivation, if our purpose, if our spirit is to actually perform our work, and we like to do our work as a noble offering to the Supreme, then that work itself and the joy of doing that work brings us into deeper and deeper inner experiences of spirituality. That is what Gita teaches. You don't have to give up your work. You simply have to learn how to perform your work in divine consciousness. And then your work itself becomes a very inseparable part of your spiritual path. Monks have work too, but a different type of work. It's like they spent all day cooking for you today. That's work. They're not getting paid money for it, but they're feeling great satisfaction because they're doing it to help others, to serve others, to make others happy. Yes? And because of that, they're happy. So they're dovetailing their natural propensities. They like to cook, sometimes. But because they're cooking for a noble spiritual purpose in harmony with their own souls, then it's wonderful. So yes, our human desire to enjoy when it is harmonized or dovetailed according to spiritual principles is a very inseparable part of the path of perfection. Does that answer your question? Should we have one more question? No more questions. Okay. Say one more question. No, you asked so many. You could ask after. I wish to thank you for your kind patience. It's been a great joy and happiness being amongst you. With your permission, we could end this program with chanting. I'll explain something about the chanting. There are many mantras. Man means the mind, tra means to deliver or free. So mantra means that sound vibration which liberates the mind from anxiety, suffering, and bondage. And how does it do so? Because mantra means it is a transcendental sound vibration which awakens our original transcendental consciousness. Originally we are all Krishna conscious or God conscious. But somehow or other, due to conditionings in this world, we have forgotten that virtue within our hearts. It has been covered by so many distractions. So this chanting of the names of the Lord awaken the inner essence of our hearts. Awaken the inner love, the inner peace of the soul. Chaito Dharapana Marajanam. The mind is considered to be like a mirror. Now, when you look in the mirror, what are you supposed to see? We're supposed to see ourselves. But if the mirror is covered by layers and layers and layers of dirt and debris, then what do you see when you look in the mirror? All you see is that dirt and debris. There's not even a dim reflection of oneself. So the mantra is meant to clean the mirror of the mind, to clean the illusions, the misconceptions, the unhealthy attachments and aversions, and actually make the mind very pure and clean, so that through the mind we actually see who we really are, the reflection of the eternal, all-blissful soul. The soul is Satchidananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. That's who we are. That's what we are. And when the mind is clean, it reflects our own pure, original image. So the purpose of mantra is to clean the heart, clean the mind, and awaken our original consciousness. That original consciousness is a consciousness that knows God, that loves God, and that loves every living being, spontaneously and naturally. Is there a greater need in this world than people having those qualities? A true spiritual person is not antagonistic or hateful to people who are different than them. A true saintly person is compassionate even to someone who wants to kill them. Yes? Jesus forgave the people who were torturing him. Haridas Thakur was praying for the forgiveness of people who were trying to kill him. We hate the disease, but we love the disease because we understand that diseased person is our brother, is our sister. That is love, universal love. It is within us. The mantra awakens that propensity within us. And how does it do so? Because the name of God is non-different from God himself. It's a spiritual vibration which has the power to clean us. If the Supreme is all-attractive, when we come in contact with the all-attractive, we become attracted like a magnet. Yes? When a magnet is close to metal, when the metal is covered by all kinds of pollution, it's not able to reciprocate with the magnetic force of the magnet. But as the metal becomes clean, it becomes spontaneously attracted. So our hearts, our consciousness, is by nature to be attracted to the all-attractive. And as it becomes purified, clean, that attraction is natural. So that is the purpose of this mantra. Whether we're Hindus or Jains or Parsis or Zoroastrians or Muslims or Christians or Jews, or whether we have, or Buddhists, or whether we have no religion at all, doesn't matter. Our nature is to love God, and this mantra awakens that love. It's a universal process of re-spiritualizing our lives. And when we chant this mantra, especially in the company of people who are sincere, it has very, very great potency to gradually restore anandam buddhivardhanam pratipadam. That the pleasure, the experience of happiness that we're all searching for in life can actually be realized through the chanting of the holy names. So that is why we chant. And when we chant together, not only does it purify our own hearts, but the unified energy of all of us chanting together actually manifests this purifying holy vibration into the atmosphere to help spiritualize people all over the world. So that is what this chanting is about. It is a meditation. It's a meditation to awaken our bhakti, or our natural devotion. So I'd like to teach you how to do. The first mantra is Hare, which means the devotional energy of the Lord. Radharani is the devotional energy of the Lord. Everyone please say Hare.
Hare.
And the next is Krishna, which means the all-attractive one. And Rama means the reservoir of all pleasure. So the mantra is Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Hare
Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna
Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hari Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hari Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Would you like to sit and chant or stand and chant? Or dance and chant? All of you have the choice of any of the three above. If you like to dance, we'll show you a nice way. Whoever would like could stand up and I will show. Everyone please stand up.